all the horrors of all the ages. The Great War redrew the lines of our world in ways that affect us today. By Alan W. Dowd. World War I had many names. It was initially called the Great War because it was so sweeping in its reach and for the number of nations it drew into its vortex. H.G. Wells famously called it the war that will end war. Americans called it the European War until the United States was drawn in and newspapers began calling it the World War. President Woodrow Wilson described it as the most terrible and disastrous of all wars, believing that its very destructiveness would convince nations of the futility of war, and that he could somehow build a concert for peace out of the rubble. Those labels lasted barely two decades, as a far more terrible, more disastrous war engulfed the world a generation later, a testament to how wrong the peacemakers at Versailles were. We still live in the long shadows cast by the peace they made and the war they waged a century ago. What the war wrought. Some historians say it was inevitable. Imperial Germany was emerging as a global power in the early 20th century. The Kaiser felt hemmed in and wanted a bigger slice of the world's riches, as evidenced by his lunges toward the Philippines, Venezuela, and Morocco in the years before the war. These incidents explain why President Theodore Roosevelt, as historian Edmund Morris writes, considered the Kaiser the most dangerous man in the world. Military strength swelled across Europe. German military expenditures more than doubled between 1910 and 1914. In the 14 years before the war, Russia's army grew by 16%, France's by 27%, and Britain's warship tonnage almost tripled. Yet, at the same time, European nations enjoyed deep commercial connections. German iron ore imports from France grew 60-fold between 1900 and 1913. Britain accounted for more than 14% of Germany's exports. Many believed such trade linkages made war unthinkable. Then came the summer of 1914, the assassination in Sarajevo, and a cascade of secret treaties. Winston Churchill described World War I as the moment when all the horrors of all the ages were brought together. Indeed, the mating of fully industrialized 20th-century empires with 19th-century conceptions of warfare yielded an unprecedented level of killing. Some 10 million troops died during 52 months of war, more than the combat dead from all the wars in the preceding century combined. The war employed both new and old technologies for killing: fighter planes, flamethrowers, tanks, water-cooled machine guns, maneuverable submarines, industrialized chemical arsenals. Germany was the first to use poison gas during the war, launching a chlorine attack in Belgium in April 1915. It worked, killing some 5,000 troops, and the Allies followed suit. By the end of the war, chemical weapons had killed 91,000. Post-war treaties tried to close Pandora's box, but chemical weapons have been used in 11 conflicts since 1919, most recently in Syria in 2013. Anglo-French forces lost 600,000 men during the Battle of the Somme, all to nudge the front 7 miles along. Germany lost almost 300,000 men trying to capture Verdun and failed. These ghastly casualty figures underscore why Wilson described leading America into the Great War as a fearful thing. Not every byproduct of the war was an instrument of war, however. It produced the American Legion, which was born in Paris in March 1919, air traffic control systems, international cooperation to combat hunger, and a revolution in battlefield medicine. Mobile X-ray machines, antiseptic treatment of wounds, reconstructive surgery, and preventive inoculation. All these innovations would serve mankind in peacetime. The war also served as a proving ground for men like Dwight Eisenhower, who commanded a tank maneuver training center, Douglas MacArthur, who led offensives in France, George Patton, who earned a Distinguished Service Cross in the U.S. Tank Corps, and William Halsey, who earned a Navy Cross commanding destroyers in the Atlantic. Foe neutrality. These men were serving a remarkably naive commander-in-chief. Wilson, after all, expected nations fighting for their survival to observe the legal nuances and niceties of America's strange brand of neutrality, although he vowed to be neutral in fact as well as in name, impartial in thought as well as in action. The United States loaned the Allies $2.5 billion in the war's first 2 years, while loaning the Central Powers less than one-tenth that amount. It was equally naive of Wilson to think that words would compel Germany to respect America's foe neutrality. When German U-boats began attacking merchant ships, the president said he would hold the Kaiser to strict accountability. Yet when Americans were killed aboard Falaba, Lusitania, and Arabic, he responded by writing letters. To be fair, Wilson's neutrality may have been his way of making a virtue out of necessity. America was ill-prepared for war, as Roosevelt detailed in late 1914. Our Navy is lamentably short in many different material directions. There is actually but one torpedo for each torpedo tube, he wrote. For nearly 2 years, there has been no fleet maneuvering. The War Department set a goal of fielding 2 million troops in 1917. But between April and December of that year, the United States deployed only 200,000 troops to Europe, all of whom were still in training. France and Britain initially supplied John Pershing's men with mortars and artillery. This was predictable and avoidable. In the 8 years before entering World War I, the United States devoted an average of 0.7% of GDP to defense. Still, U.S. manpower and materiel turned the tide. America's productive strength was unequaled, historian Paul Kennedy observes, noting that it churned out merchant ships by the hundreds. U.S. factories could produce a 7,500-ton ship in 3 days. Between mid-1917 and the end of the war, U.S. automakers built some 20,000 Liberty aircraft engines. Nearly 5 million Americans served, and 116,516 died in Europe's Civil War. A phrase loaded with dynamite. It would be an irony of fate if my administration had to deal chiefly with foreign affairs, Wilson remarked before his inauguration. Yet in drafting his peace plan, he proved himself a visionary statesman. Wilson's 14 points were so visionary that the world was not ready to embrace them in 1919 and still wrestles with them today. He envisioned a partnership of democratic nations, the rights of nations great and small to choose their way of life, open covenants of peace openly arrived at, freedom of navigation upon the seas, removal of trade barriers, reduction of armaments, impartial adjustment of all colonial claims, borders based on recognizable lines of nationality, autonomous development for national minorities, all undergirded by a general association of nations for the purpose of affording mutual guarantees of political independence and territorial integrity. Embedded in Wilson's post-war plan was the principle of self-determination. Peoples may now be dominated and governed only by their own consent, he declared. Self-determination is not a mere phrase. It is an imperative principle of actions which statesmen will henceforth ignore at their peril. Wilson's own Secretary of State, Robert Lansing, called it a phrase loaded with dynamite. It will, I fear, cost thousands of lives. Pointing to Wilson's intemperate declarations, Lansing asked, when the president talks of self-determination, what unit does he have in mind? Does he mean a race, or a territorial area, or a community? Without a definite unit that is practical, application of this principle is dangerous to peace and stability. Wilson may have sensed the tides of history carrying humanity toward decentralization and democratization, but Lansing's instincts were right. In 1900, there were 57 independent countries. Today there are nearly 200. Many of them came into existence through self-determination movements. Many of those movements triggered wars. Consider the United Nations' newest member, South Sudan, which fought to secede from Sudan and is now in the midst of a fight that could further divide the country. Or Kosovo, which cut itself away from Serbia and is now dealing with a Serbian enclave that wants to cut itself away from Kosovo. Or Ukraine, which may divide into Russian and Ukrainian statelets, or Iraqi Kurdistan, which wants to turn its autonomy into independence. Of course, these examples speak to the great sweep of Wilson's vision. Much of what he advocated, an international order seeking peaceful settlement of disputes, an international organization committed to heading off great power conflict, international borders determined by nationalities, open markets, open treaties, was accepted in 1945. Seeds of Destruction. The war left in its wake a trail of bitter ironies and broken promises. It began with Europe's empires dominating the world, but it left the continent broke and broken. Total European indebtedness to the United States surpassed $11.6 billion, the rough equivalent of $157.8 billion today. Europe was smashed into a jagged jumble of ethno-national shards. The war gave us the Weimar Republic, seedbed for Hitler's Nazis, the Polish Corridor, and French acquisitions of resource-rich German lands, seedbed for Hitler's territorial grievances, and a dismembered Germany, seedbed for Hitler's Anschluss. All told, Germany lost 13% of its territory and 10% of its population at Versailles. The war rolled back the frontiers of Russia, resurrected an independent Poland, and midwifed new nations from the Adriatic to the Baltic, all of which would be undone by Hitler and Stalin. The war ended the Russian Empire, but spawned the Russian Revolution, which spawned the Soviet Union, which gave the world something far worse than the Tsar. Wilson promised peace without victory, and Germany seized upon his plan as a face-saving way to end the war. But Wilson's partners were not in a magnanimous mood when they arrived at Versailles. Their concerns related to the future weakening of a strong and dangerous Germany, to revenge and to the shifting by the victors of their unbearable financial burdens onto the shoulders of the defeated, John Maynard Keynes lamented. Nations have no right to use peace treaties to punish the children of their enemies. Germany made its final World War I debt payment in 2010. Wilson envisioned a world made safe for democracy. Yet as historians Felix Gilbert and David Clay Large note, after 15 years, with the exception of Czechoslovakia, not one of the states created or reorganized at the Paris Peace Conference remained a democracy. And some pieces of post-war Europe, Soviet Russia, Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, became virulently anti-democratic. The term post-war is itself an irony. After all, the war to end wars did the very opposite. World War II was a continuation of World War I, and so the adjective post-war was soon replaced by interwar. The war was romanticized when the guns thundered to life in August 1914, but those who survived the trenches realized that the Great War was more apocalyptic than romantic. Like Revelation's Four Horsemen, it brought conflict. 28 nations were engaged. Famine. Belgium starved. Germany survived on turnips. Austria's cities went hungry. Death. 10 million soldiers and 6 million civilians died. And pestilence. The 1918 to 1919 influenza pandemic claimed 50 million lives. Clarity and strength. We can virtually plot recent U.S. military interventions and many of today's hottest hotspots by glancing at the maps drawn after the Great War. The post-war creation known as Yugoslavia was a miniature empire run by the Serbs, historian Paul Johnson writes. From the very beginning, these South Slavs, some Catholic, some Muslim, some Orthodox, did not get along, but they remained glued together until 1992, when Yugoslavia finally came undone. The wars that dismembered Yugoslavia, now 7 countries, claimed some 250,000 lives. The League of Nations entrusted much of the Ottoman Empire's wreckage to Britain and France. They would haphazardly stitch together or tear apart ethno-religious groupings that should have been handled with more care. Kurds, Shiites, and Sunnis crammed together in Iraq and Syria. Lebanon separated from Syria, dangled promises of a Jewish homeland in the middle of an Arab-dominated Palestine. Not surprisingly, the region has barely seen a moment's peace. Iraq has made war against 4 of its neighbors, prompting repeated U.S. intervention. There have been 4 major Arab-Israeli wars, 2 Intifada uprisings, and brutal civil wars in Lebanon, Iraq, and Syria. Lebanon's civil war claimed 120,000 lives, Syria's 150,000 and counting, and Iraq's Sunni-Shiite war 825 per month and counting. As to some of the war's lessons, a common refrain is that Europe's arms race triggered World War I. If this were true, then A, there shouldn't have been a World War II, since the Allies allowed their arsenals to atrophy after World War I, and B, there should have been a World War III, since the United States and the Soviet Union engaged in an unprecedented arms race. The reality is that miscalculation lit the fuse of World War I. The antidote, as we have learned in the intervening century, is clarity plus strength. Arms alone aren't enough to deter war. After all, the great powers were armed to the teeth in 1914, but since they weren't clear about their treaty commitments, a small crisis on the fringes of Europe mushroomed into a global war. Nor is clarity alone enough to deter war. After all, Wilson's words to the Kaiser were clear, but America lacked deterrent military strength. History and hope. The men who crafted the West's post-World War II blueprint applied the clarity plus strength model to prevent the Cold War from turning hot. It remains to be seen whether the world will follow their example in what may be today's equivalent of pre-war Europe, the Asia-Pacific region. As before, a rising authoritarian power feels hemmed in and entitled. Strategic uncertainties abound. Territorial claims remain unsettled. The scope of treaty commitments is uncertain. Military arsenals are swelling, and trade is booming. Total Japan-China trade is $334 billion annually. U.S.-China trade is $562 billion annually. Still, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe sees his nation and China in a similar situation to Britain and Germany on the eve of World War I. Kevin Rudd, former Prime Minister of Australia, draws parallels to pre-war Europe in the South China Sea, a region riven by overlapping alliances, loyalties, and hatreds, and simmering with a mix of primitive nationalisms and great power politics, all the while U.S. defense spending is ebbing to levels not seen since the interwar years. We can hope that America has enough residual muscle to maintain the balance and begin to speak with sufficient clarity to prevent miscalculation, and that trade ties prevent a great war in the Pacific. But Joint Chiefs Chairman General Martin Dempsey expects the risk of interstate conflict in East Asia to rise. And historian Robert Kagan ominously warns, history has not been kind to the theory that strong trade ties prevent conflict among nations. The United States and China are no more dependent on each other's economies today than were Great Britain and Germany before World War I.